The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Thursday, September the 8th. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. September the 9th, excuse me. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live. I say the 9th, I'm counting days. It's America Held Hostage Day 10. That's really America Held Hostage 2.0 Day 10. But I'm excited to bring some tentative good news. Three and a half hours ago now, the Taliban announced they would allow 200 Americans and Reuters relayed other civilians to leave Afghanistan, according to U.S. and officials. Taliban forces stand guard at the entrance to Hamid Karzai International Airport a day after U.S. troops withdraw in Kabul, is the photograph. Taliban authorities have agreed to let 200 American civilians and third country nationals who remained in Afghanistan after the end of the U.S. evacuation to depart on charter parts from Kabul Airport, U.S. officials said. The Taliban were pressed to allow departures by U.S. Special Representative Khalilzad and the official who spoke to Reuters on the condition of anonymity. So assume that it's Khalilzad. The departures were expected on Thursday. The official could not say whether these Americans and third country nationals were among the people stranded, they should say held hostage, for days in Mazar-i-Sharif because their private charters have not been allowed to depart. Then, approximately 2 hours ago, the Wall Street Journal reported Taliban to allow 200 Americans, other foreigners, to fly out of Kabul. I'm reading the Yaroslav Trofimov and Dion Nissenbaum story from Kabul Dateline. Afghanistan Taliban authorities are allowing some 200 Americans and other foreign citizens to leave the country on a flight to Qatar, scheduled for Thursday, the first such departure since U.S. forces withdrew last month, Qatari and American officials said. The expected flight by a Qatar Airways Boeing 777 would mark the resumption of international passenger operations at Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport. Expected to be followed by daily links to foreign countries, a senior Qatari official said. The Qatari official said it wasn't an evacuation flight, as all the passengers hold foreign passports and if required, visas to their destinations. That's important. I'll come back to that in a second. And have been ticketed by the airline. Qatar is facilitating the movement to the airport in a convoy of minibuses that were parked Thursday morning in a Kabul hotel, one of them with a bullet hole through the windshield. Most of the foreign citizens still in Afghanistan are dual nationals. The Taliban have consistently pledged to allow foreigners to leave unimpeded. At Tuesday's press conference announcing the formation of their new government, the movement's spokesman and new deputy information minister, Zabula Mujahid, said the problem with international travel would be resolved soon. Quote, when Afghans and foreigners want to leave Afghanistan, they should do it lawfully, having a passport and a visa. Now, the visas are important because the SIV-eligible people that we abandon, our allies that worked with us for 20 years, don't have an SIV, a special immigrant visa. They're screwed. So we're not going to get them out. There's a hostage crisis even after Americans get out, if Americans get out. The Wall Street Journal story continues. U.S. forces rendered the radar and other equipment at Kabul Airport inoperable. I'm not quite sure I believe that. It's a Taliban statement. I don't believe that. We wanted people to get out after us. We did not want them to shoot down our airplanes as we left. We did leave inoperable helicopters and many other things. I can't believe we did other than flip a couple of switch and the Taliban have no idea how to run a radar. The Qatar sent teams of technicians to restore flight control capabilities and Ariana Afghan Airlines resumed flight by sight domestic connections to the cities of Mazar-i-Sharif, Kandahar, and Herat on Saturday. The flight planned for Thursday doesn't address the issues of tens of thousands of Afghans at risk who haven't been able to leave the country during the U.S.-led airlift. The U.S. has estimated that the majority of Afghans who qualify for the so-called special immigrant visa because of having helped American military and civilian efforts remain stranded. So more than 50% we left behind. While Washington said last Monday to receive commitments from the Taliban to allow Afghans with clearance to enter foreign nations to fly out, the country's new authorities desperately want to prevent a brain drain that won't undermine any effort to stave off economic collapse. Now, Tony Blinken was asked about this in Germany yesterday. His first comment on the record, actually, this was at a Doha presser. Are you sure this is Doha? I thought this was Germany, Dwayne.
It actually probably was Germany. Okay, Germany. Left Doha and went to Germany.
Yeah. Cut number two.
With regard to the composition of this government or interim government, I noted the fact that it certainly does not meet the test of inclusivity, and it includes people who have very challenging track records.
Challenging track records means it includes terrorists. Of course it does. It's got the Haqqani network running security, who's allied with Al-Qaeda. It's a disaster, and the Secretary of State Blinken, as Chris Wallace noted on this show on Wednesday, for whom Chris Wallace has no respect, and I doubt the Taliban care at all, went on to add or said earlier this, cut number three.
As of now, the Taliban are not permitting the charter flights to depart. They claim that some of the passengers do not have the required documentation. While there are limits to what we can do without personnel on the ground, without an airport with normal security and procedures in place, we are working to do everything in our power to support those flights and to get them off the ground.
Now, it sounds to me, if I read the tea leaves, that the Taliban are achieving a kind of symbolic victory by making people get off the planes in Mazar-e-Sharif and bus or drive down to Kabul and leave on the Qatari 777. I have my eyes on the news. It's the most important story. Americans held hostage are always the most important story. This is America Held Hostage 2.0, day 10. And we got to pray that those 200 people get out. But I ask you to consider that if there are 200 Americans on that plane, this administration has been telling you it's closer to 100, in the low 100s. So that means they will have been lying. We don't know. We have to wait and see, and we will hear the stories of everyone on that airplane about what the U.S. government did or didn't do. But how do you trust the government? How do you trust Joe Biden and Tony Blinken about the number of Americans still left behind, the number of green card holders who are Americans? We should just call Americans, not citizens and green card holders. They're all Americans. How many Americans have a right to be here who are still in Afghanistan and can't get papers? And then the Afghans are setting this up. We'll let you leave if you have a visa. Well, we left the majority of people who were owed visas in Afghanistan. The great bankruptcy of the Biden administration is abandoning people in Afghanistan. That's the number one story. And I'm going to stick on this story. I'm not going to let it go. It is like January of 2020, when I may have been the only person in the United States daily warning you about what was going on with a virus in China. Every single day, I warned you about that. I told you that things were happening in Wuhan, that a patient had arrived in Southern California and that was not being tracked. The patient arrived in Northern California and the public health officials weren't telling us. I am a voice of doom on some stories. This is a voice of doom story. Follow me on this. I will give you great news when great news arrives. I'll lead with it. First thing Dwayne told me when I came into the studio today is Wall Street Journal updated the 200 people may be getting out. So I went and researched it. I will celebrate with all of you. I will pray with all of you when Americans get out. But right now, I trust no one in this weak and collapsing government of Joe Biden. I had a very candid talk with a former national security official yesterday, not Robert O'Brien. Everyone thinks it's always Robert O'Brien. I did not talk to O'Brien yesterday. Another senior official from Team Trump telling me how god-awful this is. And people are leaking like a sieve. There will be no paper, I am told. No record of no ROM that will be released by the White House, record of meeting among a deputy's meeting. There will be no paper from the White House to the Pentagon, to Secretary Austin or the Deputy Secretary Call on when to shut down Bagram vis-a-vis Karzai Airport. There will be no paper trail and a wall of silence, and the media wants to go along with that and help rehabilitate Joe Biden, whose number is now below 40 in many polls. There is no rehabilitating a man who left Americans behind, because you know that means you'll be left behind. Last night, the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I watched the Benedict Cumberbatch movie, The Courier. At one point, one character says the other, no one will ever trust MI6 again if you leave the man behind to be killed. And indeed, they left the man behind to be killed. They got the Brit back. This will be a halfway solution. But if those 200 Americans come out, if that flight takes off, hurrah. You'll hear about it if it happens during this show live, as soon as it does, because that's good news. But you'll also hear that Team Biden is incompetent, inept, and the president is infirm. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, Americans. Hugh Hewitt, joined now from Israel by Dr. Michael Oren. Good morning, Dr. Oren. Welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I always appreciate your visits.
Good to be with you, Hugh. Hi.
What is happening on the West Bank? Reports of violence and rioting after a prison break. Would you give us a summary?
Yeah, it was a prison break. It's embarrassing. Six high-security prisoners escaped from a prison up north. They dug a tunnel, you know, something out of the movies. And there's searches going on. And while searches are going on, people, Palestinians in the Judean Samaria, are rioting. They're not huge riots. I don't think it's going to spin out of control. But unpleasant. The whole thing is unpleasant and embarrassing.
So it is not, however, a crisis. Whenever I look at newspapers, I wonder whether or not it's just selling newspapers or a genuine crisis. In your view, it's not going to escalate into conflict along either the northern or the southern border?
No, we got bigger fish to fry. I published an article in the Israeli press last Friday that said we have to look to the winter to the possibility that Iran might break out and create an actual bomb. They're very close. You know, they're now producing over 60%, which is a very small distance between 60% and 90%, which is, you know, weapons grade. And with the United States in disarray after Afghanistan, with a rather weak Israeli government, and with inclement weather, which will impair the ability of our Air Force to intervene, Iran could pick a date in January and just break out, and the world won't do anything. And my bottom line in this article is that Israel has to start building its case, because no one's going to defend us. We're going to have to defend ourselves.
Now, Secretary Blinken warned yesterday that the U.S. is getting closer to giving up on Iran nuclear deal. That's a bit of good news. We should have given up on a nuclear deal forever ago, and that the appeasers are not doing, are even when you lose the appeasers, then you realize that finally Iran's hardliners have gotten through to the knuckleheads in the West. Once we give up, isn't that a green light to Israel to act?
You think so, but I think that the United States, in addition to you know, being in disarray after Afghanistan, will do probably everything possible it can to prevent Israel from acting for fear that Israel would drag into another Middle Eastern war, about the last thing America would do. Wouldn't it be wonderful, Hugh, if the United States reversed 20 years of defeat and humiliation in Iraq and Afghanistan, if in a single night it took out Iran's nuclear program?
Yes, it would. And by the way, that's got to be tempting to Team Biden because of their numbers and the fiasco associated with Blinken, Winken, and Nod over there at the White House. The deal is, Dr. Oren, you're right to bring this up and to bring it up every week between now and then so it doesn't surprise people. The Israelis are not going to let Iran break out. Am I right about that? It's not going to happen.
No, read my lips. We cannot. Can't. You understand that once Iran gets the bomb, right, then Hezbollah, Hamas can act with impunity. When we try to defend ourselves against terror, we're going to have a nuclear bomb to our heads. You know, there's this crazy notion in Washington. There are people who actually want Iran to get a bomb so that there'll be like Cold War era mutually assured destruction in the Middle East. And somehow in their imagination, a nuclear armed Iran will be a source of stability in the Middle East. Believe it or not, there are actually people who think that. They do not understand the nature of the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime is not the Soviet Union.
You know, Dr. Oren, stop there. They really think that Khamenei is Khrushchev. They read 13 Days by Graham Allison. They think that Khamenei is going to back down for some diplomatic nicety. They don't get it. He's a theocrat. He's not going to back down.
Not just that. Once they get the bomb, they're not going to sit there with the bomb. They're going to keep coming at us, you know, through Hezbollah, through proxies. And you know, every time we try to defend ourselves, we're going to go on nuclear alert.
it's a religious fanatics might think it's a great thing to blow up Iran and Israel. This is the problem. I don't think people in the West get it. They don't mind being martyrs. There are hundreds of thousands of martyrs honored in Iran every year. Am I right?
It's like my old professor, Bernard Lewis, used to say that mutually assured destruction for the Iranian regime is an incentive.
That, he was a great man.
I wish I could take credit for that. It was Bernard Lewis.
Yeah, but, he was a great man. What Went Wrong? One of the great books of the last 20 years. So, Dr. Oren, do we have a hostage crisis, in your view, in Afghanistan right now?
I don't know. It could be. I the Taliban, you know, they're also jihadists. You know, they announced yesterday that they're happy to establish relations with every country in the world except the State of Israel.
Right.
What a source of pride. What a source of pride for us.
Yeah, that's true. But
really,
their announcements that they're going to let 200 Americans out today, and Team Biden's going to say, whoopee, it's over. I don't believe the Haqqani network. I don't trust. I just believe they've got Americans stashed away. What do you intuit?
I wouldn't put it past them. Keep in mind who you're dealing with. You're not dealing with a regime that is operating on sort of, you know, Western principles of even self-interest, what we would perceive as self-interest. It was the fatal flaw in the Obama administration's attitude toward Iran, that the Iranian regime operates on a cost-benefit analysis, okay, on this basis. But it wasn't true, because their benefit are different benefits, not economic benefits, it's theological benefits. It's very different.
That's so well put. Theological benefits are different, difficult to calculate for people who are not theology-based, especially when it's a fanatic theology. Dr. Michael Oren on Twitter, Dr. Michael Oren, of course, always welcome back, the former ambassador of Israel to the United States, former deputy minister of Israel. Thank you, Michael Oren. I'll be right back, America. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway on this September 9th as we approach the 20th anniversary of September 11th. And as the Afghan debacle continues to unfold before us, we wait for news, none yet, of a flight leaving Kabul, allegedly with 200 Americans on it, for Qatar. We hope that happens. The hostage crisis will not be over. If it does, we'll just begin to have a sense of how large it is. I'm joined by historian Tevi Troy, senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, former senior White House official. On August 22nd, he authored an op-ed in the journal entitled All the President's Yes Men. Good morning, Tevi. How are you?
Hey, Hugh. Thanks. It's good to hear you. And I'm hopeful that we get some good people out of Afghanistan, and there's more to do.
I agree, and I want people to know you've got a new book out called Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. You're going to have to put out a new edition with this collapsing White House. Let me read from your op-ed, I think, the key part. Part of the problem with the Biden Afghanistan decision-making process was that the president didn't appear to be hearing dissent from his political aides. Some military and intel advisors seemed to have pushed back against withdrawal, but his top political aides, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, were reluctant to do so. The pair raised the possibility of Taliban attacks on U.S. forces and diplomats, but neither disagreed with Mr. Biden, knowing he had made up his mind. This is reminiscent of Johnson and the Vietnam War. Indeed, it is, Jake, Tevi. And I talked last night with a former national security senior person saying, we'll never get the record of memorandum, the ROM, from the deputies meeting. Highly unlikely that we have a White House piece of paper going to Lloyd Austin. There might be a presidential decision memorandum. We're just never going to know what's going to happen until people start to tell tales. When do you think we'll finally get the real story on the Afghanistan meltdown?
Well, I think there will be some memoirs that come out. In the previous administration, they came out during the administration. More frequently, they come out after an administration ends. And then also the oral histories that come out 10 years after an administration ends. But that's frustrating, not only as a historian, but for you, who someone who's watching the news and wants to comment on it, the Biden administration has been a little closed-lipped, and sometimes that's a sign of discipline and a good thing. But in Biden world, it said, and I wrote in the op-ed, that Biden dislikes process stories. He doesn't want to read about what's going on, which, again, can be a good thing, but it can also mean that there's a stultifying atmosphere in the administration that doesn't allow for conversation and dissent.
Well, over the weekend, it became obvious to me that the White House was going to throw General Milley under the bus. They began to say it was Milley's decision to close Bagram. And I know someone who's remotely in Milley's circle. And I said, look, my suggestion is before the chief of staff testifies, chairman testifies, get every piece of paper lined up, collated and in order. Get your story straight because you never get to change it after the first appearance. And make sure that the chairman's fully briefed and sticks to his story. Because that's when if they're going to throw someone under the bus, you don't want the tire tracks need to be as few as possible when they go over you.
Yeah, that's true. You do need it. But I also think Milley's going to be in a lonely place. I think Republicans don't love how he handled things in the last administration. I think his answers on critical race theory of the military weren't great in a congressional hearing recently. And then obviously the Biden administration seemed ready to throw him under the bus. So he might be lonely. I assume he'll get a memoir out of this, but I don't know who's going to buy it.
Well, this is the fourth episode in which he's featured prominently. Now, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff matters every day, but he featured on the Lafayette Park clearing. He featured on January 6th. He featured on the critical race theory debate. This is by far the most important. And my sources tell me almost certainly the Pentagon discussed options with Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken. And they said, we can't keep three places safe. Pick two. And that the White House picked two. Or give us more troops. And the White House said no. They're almost certain that it would be Dr. Call, who's the undersecretary for policy, who worked with Jake Sullivan because they're part of the team Obama-Biden. What do you make of that theory? It's just a theory based upon experience in the White House, Tevi Troy.
Yeah, again, we don't know for sure, but that does sound right to me that the military said we want to do X. X might include Bagram. And if the Biden team said, well, you can't have the troops that would be required to do that, then the military said, okay, we're going to have to come up with a different option. Look, the military are not the political folks. They don't make those kind of decisions. They say, okay, give us what you're willing to do, and then we have to make the best of it. And they tried to make the best of it, but it was obviously not a good situation here.
You know, interestingly, Tevi, I know the Nixon White House better than others. I know the Reagan White House second term pretty well, but not first term. In the Nixon White House, they had institutionalized argument. Moynihan and Shultz would go at each other. Ray Price, William Sapphire, Patrick Buchanan, the murderer's row of speechwriters would go after each other. He institutionalized Henry Kissinger fighting with William Rogers. Why don't presidents follow that model? It produces better results.
Yeah, look, there's a continuum, and I talk about this in my book, Fight House. You'd need to have some kind of institutionalized argument where people can have disagreements, but at the same time, you can't have dysfunction where people hate each other so much that they're afraid that anything they say in a meeting will be leaked against them. So you need to have the place, and Karl Rove talked about this in the Bush administration, at least on the domestic side. We know the foreign policy side had its challenges, but on the domestic side, he said there was an atmosphere where people could argue and hash it out in front of the president, and even if they were on opposite sides, they would walk out of the room once the president made the decisions, locked arms, and on the same side. And it's hard to do. It's just not easy because some people say, okay, no fighting, and some people say, well, you know, let it rip. You have to find the right sweet spot.
General McChrystal, in his wonderful memoir and then his follow-on book, Team of Rivals, tells the story, and I think General Mattis did the same thing, of planting dissent in a big staff meeting. He made a colonel stand up and argue with him and have a pretty vigorous back and forth to demonstrate that dissent was welcome and the colonel would not be published. Do you think that's a good idea for most presidents to follow?
It is potentially, but if the colonel is a straw man, right, if McChrystal sets it up so that he just beats up on the colonel and then wins the day every time, you know, if it's like the Harlem Globetrotters.
The other way. It was set up, though, that the colonel would win and McChrystal would change his mind or Mattis would change his mind. They both did a similar thing to prove that it was useful to the commander to get feedback that he would listen. That's what they were demonstrating, capacity to listen.
I think that is useful, to show that you can push back against the leader, again, in a respectful way and change minds if that is what is appropriate in that situation. And look you know, in my book, in Fight House, I talk about Harry Truman, how he set up a fight on whether to recognize Israel with Clark Clifford, who was the junior guy, against the Secretary of State, who was a General Marshall, who was a revered person in Truman Land. And Clifford wins the day, and the U.S. recognized Israel, and it's a good thing. But that's only because Truman was willing to set up that debate and allow both parties to have their say.
You also need, I think, and I wonder if this is in White House, a first friend. Now, I think in this administration, it's Chris Dodd, the former senator from Connecticut, who can say absolutely anything to their longtime buddy, including, are you out of your mind? You've got to give them numbers on how many Americans are held hostage. Or Harry Hopkins to FDR, his assessment of Churchill when he went over in 1940 to search, or maybe it was 41, to search out Churchill. Does Joe Biden have a first friend in your view? Did President Obama, notoriously aloof and alone, don't we need a first friend to speak truth to Caesar?
Yeah, I mean, the first friend is an interesting concept. Gary Ginsburg just wrote that book on it. I think that's useful, but you can't count on a president having friends. I mean, you know, as you know well, Nixon's best friend was B.B. Rebozo.
Right.
He liked B.B. because B.B. would just listen to him and would never push back. So I think you need a chief of staff who is going to say, sir, you're off base on this, or sir, you should listen to this other perspective. And what I talk about in my Wall Street Journal piece was that the top political aides knew that Biden's mind was made up, so they didn't want to push back on him because they thought it was a foregone conclusion.
Well, the reality is in front of us, and now I want to ask for your prediction, Tevi. They're making a calculated choice to bury the story. Are they creating a crisis for themselves by not talking about the crisis?
I think you need to show that you can do something different as a result of this disastrous decision-making process. So is it firings? Is it changing the decision-making process? Is it announcing a full and open after-action report? Maybe some combination of all those things. But it does seem to me that they do want to bury it. And, you know, the media will probably help them and go back to asking about ice cream.
You know, last question. Chris Wallace was on the show this week, and he stunned me by saying, I just don't really care what Tony Blinken says. I'm unimpressed with him. He doesn't have the gravitas of Colin Powell or Hillary Clinton or Mike Pompeo. When broadcasters are dismissive of the Secretary of State, what's that say about what the Taliban probably thinks of the Secretary of State?
Well, look, it's not just the Taliban, but the whole world. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese. I mean, I think everybody is looking at the U.S. as a less important force and a less forceful force for good in the world today. And it's an unfortunate thing.
It's a punching bag administration, and it's going to stay that way. Tevi Troy, great piece in The Wall Street Journal. Congratulations on Fight House, the new book. Stay tuned, America. I'll be right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show, at the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega, temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains, temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains, and you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, inside the Beltway Live. Minutes ago, CNN reporting that the plane with 200 Americans, according to Reuters and the Wall Street Journal, has taken off from Kabul Airport. They'll be heading to Doha. We will learn more, and I will report the breaking news as it arrives. I'm joined now by Michael Shear of the New York Times. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, sir.
Do you have any details to add about this flight?
Well, no. I mean, I think what we have is still just tons of questions, right? How many Americans and legal permanent residents of the United States are on that flight? How many of them are Afghan nationals? How many are dual citizens, Afghans and Americans, you know, and, you know, we still have lots of questions about the delay. You know, the United States has said that it's been the Taliban that was holding up the departure of some of these folks because they didn't have what the Taliban considered to be proper documentation. There's been allegations of, as I'm, you know, you've been reporting and tweeting and talking about allegations that it's been the State Department and bureaucratic delays that have prevented people, Americans, from leaving. I mean, I think we just have a ton of questions that frankly we need answers to.
Well, I think it's a hostage crisis that will get a lot less complicated if indeed there are 200 Americans. My first question is, okay, who was on the plane? The second one will be, why did you say it was in the low 100s if it's 200? It might not be 200. I mean, I who knows who's on this airplane, right? I just played Jen Psaki yesterday. Were you in the press room yesterday, Michael?
I wasn't, but I followed the exchanges that she had on this topic.
Okay, on this topic, she sounded almost like an apologist for the Taliban, saying, you know, we don't have any manifests, it's dangerous, it could, you know, we don't have any control. I understand all that, but if there are 200 Americans of any sort, residents, LPR, citizens, they've been saying in the low 100s, they've been implying like 110, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, and so you can sort of, there's two potential or maybe more, but at least two potential explanations for why you might underestimate, right, if you're the Biden administration. One is that you might really not know. It's a kind of chaotic situation over there, and you might not know for sure how many Americans are left. The other reason you might do it is you might want to sort of under promise and over deliver, right? Like, you know, if there are it'd be a much worse situation for the Biden administration if they said, hey, there's 200 or 300 or 400 and then only managed to get out 100. So, I don't know the answer to that question, but that's at least a couple of possibilities.
Yeah, Michael, I'm going to disagree with you on that. If they had said from the beginning, we don't know, then the number wouldn't matter. They have said it's closer to 100. If it turns out it's 200, and we just don't know, it's all speculative. If it's 200, that means they were lying to us or they had no reason for their estimate and they exaggerated their competence. That's why when Secretary Blinken shows up, I'm urging members of Congress to ask very specifically, okay, after the weekend's events, what is the minimum number of known Americans of any sort, dual citizens, single citizenship, LPRs,
right,
that are in Afghanistan? That question hasn't been answered because they don't want to be pinned down. They don't want to be pinned down because they don't want a political crisis to develop around the number of people that they can't get out. And I'm worried. I'm mostly worried about Americans who are getting stashed by the Haqqani network, because these are killers, right? They're not government people. They're just killers.
Right. Well, so first of all, to your first point, I am certainly sympathetic to potential questioners, meaning the members of the House or members of the Senate who are asking questions, because frankly, reporters have been asking these questions for weeks now, and have been incredibly frustrated by the lack of information, lack of specifics that the administration has been willing or able, whichever you believe, to give us. So I definitely think more questions are in order. I think. You know, there's concern on a number of levels for the people that are in Afghanistan. I mean, I think, you know, first and foremost, the American citizens and the folks with green cards that are there. But also, you know, a lot of Afghans who worked tirelessly, you know, alongside the United States during 20 years of war and, thought in the end that the United States would protect them. And I think a lot of those folks remain in Afghanistan. And I think those are two big concerns.
I believe the record says the majority of SIV eligibles have been left behind. That's hundreds of thousands of people, if I understand the data set correctly. I want to play for you Speaker Pelosi yesterday, Michael Scheer, and get your reaction to this. Here she is talking about the Afghanistan situation yesterday at her presser, cut number 12.
It is, I think the president made the right decision to leave Afghanistan. I think we should have left a long time ago. We should have stayed longer in the beginning to get the job done. We only routed the Taliban. We did not defeat them. And then we left to go to Afghanistan, to Iraq. But having said that, over time, I think we should have left sooner. I do think that the historic evacuation of 120,000 people was remarkable, and I commend the administration for that. This is never easy. That's not always complete right from the start, but it was remarkable, even though it got off to a hazy start. And now we go forward.
Now, Michael Scheer, there are a number of issues with that statement. First of all, her simple error, then we left to go to Iran. It's easier to jump on the fact
she must have meant Iraq. Correct?
Right. But we didn't leave to go to Iraq. I mean, that's the big error, the Iran-Iraq miscue, is an understandable slip of the tongue. But what isn't a slip of the tongue is the lie that we left to go to Iraq. We never left. We may not have devoted exclusive attention to Afghanistan. And the eloquent way of saying that is we ought never to have invaded Iraq, and we should have retained exclusive attention on Afghanistan, and we never have had that. That's an eloquent answer, but she screwed up. Then she talks about the evacuation being remarkable, but it's mostly a hazy start. What is that, Michael Scheer?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the speaker what she meant by hazy start. I think what I can say is that myself, my colleagues at the Times, other colleagues around Washington in journalism have documented what was much worse than a hazy start, right? Like it was a complete chaotic mess of an evacuation. I mean, I think that's documented by the facts. The administration has touted the number of people and the speed with which they got folks out. But I think it's hard to deny, the chaotic nature, both of the situation at the Kabul airport, but also, as I documented in a 2,500-word piece last weekend, the chaotic nature even of the bases that the folks were being taken to. We focused on Doha in Qatar, but I think the situation all around has been pretty chaotic and not well organized.
The word I used on the Washington Post first look when it first began, the Friday before the collapse, catastrophic. And I still believe it's catastrophic at a number of levels. For everyone who's left behind, the SIB eligible, the American citizens, the green card holders, and I hate the distinction between dual citizens and citizens. That's a distinction without a difference that ought not to be in our lexicon, because a citizen is a citizen and an LPR is an LPR, and they're all Americans. But it's catastrophic, and they don't want to admit that. And I understand not wanting to admit it, but we ought not to allow them to talk about it in terms of hazy. It's just that's an assault on the 13 dead Marines and the wounded. Hazy, hazy. So, Michael Scheer, the problem going forward is reclaiming credibility and trying to change the page. And now we're up against a speech tonight, and the backdrop for the speech on COVID is utter confusion in the FDA and CDC about the booster strategy. They can't communicate. Now, I don't do science. I don't question their science. I got vaccinated. I urge everyone to get vaccinated, get a booster. I do know how to communicate. If you have a message, make it simple. Repeat it 7 times. Go get a booster shot. Go get a booster shot. Go get a booster shot. They are screwing it up again. Am I wrong?
Well, it really is quite remarkable how the same dynamic keeps playing over and over again. I think in this case, the Biden administration a couple weeks ago, I lose track of time, when they encouraged when they essentially encouraged people, said we're soon to get boosters for everyone. I think they were trying to live by your mantra, right? They were trying to say a very simple, like, hey, we're going to need boosters. Everybody get ready. That's coming. And, that ran headfirst into the sort of scientists and the wonks at the FDA and the CDC, who apparently weren't ready to make that, to sort of bless that with the sort of scientist blessings that they offer. And I think that's very confusing, as you say, to the American public. Who do you believe? Do you believe the president who stood up and said, hey, we're all going to get boosters? Do you believe the, head of the CDC or the FDA who says, well, not yet? There's questions about capacity. How much of the vaccine do we have? Could we even give everybody the booster if that was the decision? So I think, we're all going to be looking to the president today to clarify some of this and to help Americans figure out, who to listen to.
Michael, this is an important question. We're 8 months into what my friends and I, responsible people, not knee-jerk critics, have now concluded is Carter 2.0, but worse. A completely ineffective mess of an administration that does not know what it's doing. Chris Wallace on this show dismissed Tony Blinken as unimpressive and compared him so unfavorably with Hillary Clinton, Colin Powell, and Mike Pompeo that I was kind of shocked. Is the fear growing? Is there a suspicion widening among the White House press corps that we really do have the Peter principle at work with this White House?
I don't know. I mean, I think, I guess I would leave it to others like yourself, to characterize whether this is, you know, Carter 2.0 or, you know, truly a dysfunctional White House. I think what the responsibility for the press corps is to, you know, be the people that hold the administration to account for its decision making. And, you know, whether that decision making, you know, goes well as it was appearing to go in the first part of the first few months of the administration when vaccinations were, you know, were going through the roof and people seemed, you know, the vaccine seemed to be working, the virus seemed to be receding. I think, you know, we hold them to account for those decisions. But when the decisions start not working as well, that we press them on that. And
but Michael, you know, quick question. We're up against a hard break. If you, Michael Scheer, conclude that the president is infirm and the White House staff weak, will you report that, or will you say that's an opinion? I won't report that.
I mean, that depends on whether it is an opinion or whether there's information to back that up. And I don't think speaking for myself and my news organization, we will not hesitate to cover legitimate news, legitimate information when we find it about this administration, just as we've done for previous administrations. You know, we won't opine and just sort of pull something out of thin air. But if there's information to back that up, I think we'll report it.
All right. I hope you do. I don't think it's thin air. I think the president is infirm and the White House is weak. But we'll see if and when the Times catches up with the people on the center right like me. Michael Scheer, always a pleasure. Scheer M on Twitter. Follow him. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. We are awaiting news on the flight that is allegedly taken off from Kabul airport that includes up to 200 Americans headed for Doha. That will be great news if it's true, if they land, and in what we find out is going on. I'm joined by Senator Jim Talent. Senator, welcome. I don't know if you heard Jen Psaki at the White House yesterday or Tony Blinken in Germany, but they sound like apologists for the Taliban.
Yeah, did you hear Blinken say, well, we don't have any assets on the ground, so we really can't verify anything. Well, yeah. That's kind of the point. You were in a position now where we are asking or begging or maybe paying for our rights. That's the situation we're in.
And then Psaki went out there and said, you know, we're not going to let people come into the United States without the right paperwork, and we're not going to let them land at military bases. If there are Americans on the plane, you do that and you worry about security when it gets there, unless they are expecting a bomb to be on the plane, right?
Yes, you have to. If there's Americans, you have to let them land. Now, we do have a problem because we didn't vet these individuals when we had the resources and the assets on the ground to do it, including the Afghan intelligence service, right? So now we're in a situation where we're caught. Obviously, we need to let the Americans in, but where we either don't let people in who helped us and to whom we have a commitment, or we risk them infiltrating terrorists, which they're perfectly capable of doing. In fact, I'd be surprised if Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not trying to do that.
I agree. Now, Senator, this week on the show, Chris Wallace is a controversial figure on the right, but he's also despised on the left. He's over at Fox News. You probably know Chris. Mm-hmm. Dismissed Tony Blinken as unimpressive, a staff guy, not like Pompeo or Hillary Clinton or Colin Powell, capable of projecting American power. That is a brutal dismissal by a broadcaster. If a broadcaster who really can't afford to lose contacts inside of an administration and worries about that sort of thing, is that brutal? What do you think the Taliban thinks about Tony Blinken?
It's a problem. But I would say, listen, I wish the problem was Tony Blinken. I'm much more concerned about what the Taliban and the Chinese and Putin and Iran, and including, by the way, our friends, think of Blinken's boss. I just, you know, I'm very concerned. Not only did they bungle the withdrawal, but the way they bungled the bungling. In other words, every time Biden speaks about this, he digs the hole in deeper. And I'm concerned that people are questioning his ability to act in a crisis. That's very dangerous.
Well, I believe that based on all the evidence that is available, and the president doesn't give me any reason not to conclude this, that he's infirm. Doesn't mean he has dementia, doesn't mean he has Alzheimer's. It just means he's an old guy about to turn 79, and he's acting like a not particularly fit 79-year-old. And that is a dangerous thing. Do you believe the American press has the capacity to actually voice that opinion upon facts and circumstances as they understand them?
Well, they ought to, and I agree. I've been saying for months, I served with this man. I mean, I watched him give speeches, and it's clear he's lost a lot. I mean, you can't have known Joe Biden and watch him now and not conclude that. I don't know, as you say, whether it's some kind of clinical condition or it's just the result of age. We do know that that kind of thing doesn't get better in a crisis, and it doesn't get better when a person's under a lot of stress for a long time. So, I don't know. You know, we're all in the world of we don't know what's going to happen with this, But, I mean, we've seen it over the course of the last month. I'm also concerned, that people in that condition can get very obstinate, right? And then you had Tevi Troy on earlier who said he didn't want to hear any dissenting opinions about what was going on in Afghanistan. So, yeah, all these are reasons for grave concern. But we can certainly... If these people are coming home, if these planes got out, that's the first good news from Afghanistan.
Yeah, and we should celebrate that. It won't be the end of the story, but we will celebrate that. So, Jim Talent, the big question, we have 3.5 years of a president who appears to me to be infirm, and 3.5 years of an incompetent White House, and 3.5 years of Tony Blinken. I mean, how worried are you?
Well, I'll tell you this. I would just be shocked if people on the Hill, leaders on the Hill, are not talking amongst themselves about this. And I don't mean in terms of something they're going to do, but they're asking exactly the question that you just asked. What do we do if this gets worse? And they're not just Republicans. In fact, probably not primarily Republicans. It's a real problem. I mean, people throw around the 25th Amendment. I mean, nobody wants that kind of a crisis.
And it doesn't work, by the way. It requires the cabinet to be. It's not the answer.
It's workable when the president himself
is incapacitated as opposed to infirm.
Yeah, he's gonna. The only times it would work is when a president would just resign, right? And you don't need it then. So I agree. I mean, we don't have a good system for dealing with this. Now, I hope this is not. I tell people I do a lot of local radio, and I always tell them, look, I don't want Joe Biden to succeed politically, but I want him to succeed in terms of foreign and national security policy. I don't want, I want a president who's fit, vigorous, energetic on top of everything. I hope this isn't true.
I know, and we pray for that, but we also have to report what our fears are.
But you can't just, who can ignore it?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people are trying to, especially as the 20th anniversary of 9/11 comes along. Senator Jim Talent is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Follow him on Twitter at Jim Talent. Follow me at the next hour of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
The lost secret notebook of Nikola Tesla with his most dangerous formulas could fall into the hands of evolutionary elite scientists.
His most amazing discoveries, thought to be written in a lost journal. In the right hands, it could revolutionize the 21st century.
They want to start a new world order where elites rule and everyday people are not created equal.
Look out!
Now the elites plan to set off an earthquake under L.A. to take out world leaders.
There's an old brown battered notebook in my office at work. You have to find it, take it, and keep it hidden at all costs.
Let's just say there are a lot of enemies of the state interested in his research.
It's up to regular people to stop them. A grad student, a campus cop, a deaf army vet, and a group of live-action role players.
A vertical quake this size could collapse half of downtown.
Catch Final Frequency, playing exclusively on SalemNow.com or download the mobile app. For more information, visit FinalFrequencyFilm.com.
Hi, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live, updating you on the airplane that is apparently taken off from Kabul. The Wall Street Journal reporting Americans, many of them appearing to be of Afghan origin, are too traumatized by the ordeal to speak to a reporter. One man from Maryland, however, accompanied by his wife and four children, came to Kabul 6 months ago to take care of his ailing mother. They have been hiding out since August 15. We thought we would never leave Afghanistan. The Taliban came to a neighboring house asking about us. Another family, one American citizen, a six-month-old girl and her parents. I was afraid so much, said the father. We will get these stories hopefully in hours. James Homan joins me from the Washington Post. Good morning, James. How are you?
Doing well, Hugh, and glad those people are getting out.
Well, I'm afraid we have a hostage crisis and we don't know how big it is. And
right.
Team Biden won't tell us because they don't want it to be a hostage crisis and they don't want it to have a number. Do you think they're going to get away with that?
Well, I mean, I don't. I think, you know, the public attention continues to be pretty intense. They're facing a lot of pressure to not move on. And, you know, I think what they would say is that giving a number also tips our hand to the Taliban. But certainly, you know, the Taliban is using these Americans who are still there as pawns to try to get money released and to try to get the U.S. to grant them legitimacy.
Now, James Homan, this calls for an opinion. Michael Scheer, in the last hour, demurred, saying he doesn't do opinions. In my opinion, President Biden is infirm. That doesn't mean dementia. It doesn't mean Alzheimer's. It just means being 78, turning 79 soon, and showing the wear and tear of 79 long years in D.C. Do you share my opinion?
Well, you know, I think he's no different than he was when the American people elected him last year. And, you know, I think ultimately the decisions that have been made are what he should be judged by. And, you know, I think that I was talking to John Bolton last week, and I said, you know, who should lose their job over what happened in Afghanistan? Is it Jake Sullivan or Tony Blinken? And Bolton said, no, those people shouldn't. They're just staff. It's ultimately the president who made these decisions. And the president owns the decisions. So that's what I've been focused on.
That was a good sidestep. So I'll go back and ask again. Do you think the president is infirm?
I don't. I mean, he's 79, and you know, I think it's it's hard to imagine my 79-year-old relatives doing the job of being president because it's such a exhausting and taxing job, and it's a 7-day week, 24-hour job, but that's not really my focus.
Do you know what the oldest NFL coach has ever been?
I don't.
73, Romeo Crennel, acting. I can, you know, Kevin Stefanik, who runs the Browns, is 39. Urban Myers is, I think, 57. People in their prime run NFL teams. I think he's infirm. That is not a clinical, that's just an opinion, and he could dispel that opinion with a few robust, I mean, it could be easily dispelled. I'd change it if he showed up and did other things than what he's done. Couldn't he change that opinion for people, Jim? And by the way, let me predicate. Do you have discussions on this subject with other people around the newsroom?
Well, I think, you know, we have, Biden should release his medical records.
That's different. I'm asking if you talk about the president being infirm around the newsroom.
It sounds like a sidestep again, Hugh, but the conversations that I have around the newsroom are very substantive and focused on the underlying policies, not on the president's.
You mean nobody says, wow, he's old?
I think it's one of those things where it's not a surprise that he's old. He seemed really old a year ago when the election was happening, and
that's not
Democratic,
you know,
voters picked him as their nominee over another really old guy.
Well, no. Trump was not as old as Biden.
No, I'm talking about Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. You're right about that. And Bernie Sanders has some of the old man syndrome. I'm just saying I believe the American press is doing the public a great disservice. It is falling down on its number one job, which is to tell them whether or not competent leadership is in charge of the nuclear arsenal in America's national security, because they're afraid of hurting people's feelings. I have never seen anything like this. It's like when FDR was failing of health and nobody was prepared when Truman became president. They didn't know the president was sick. And it was a terrible collapse on the part of the American press. And I think we're replaying, we're tiptoeing around this because it plays up what ought to have been played up in the election. But now we have real world consequences. And Let me turn to Blinken. Chris Wallace on the show. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No. I don't think that the reason for the debacle in Afghanistan is because Biden is old. I think the reason for Afghanistan is that he's an ornery Irishman who didn't want to, who felt like he got, he watched Obama get rolled by the generals in 2009, and he was dead set not to kind of be convinced to keep a residual force. And so he was insistent that he was going to be the one to get the troops out. And I think it's a disaster, and I think Biden bears responsibility for it. But I don't think that it's a disaster because of his age.
Stubbornness is not a character trait that gets better with age, Jim.
Well, I saw the Chris Wallace interview, which I thought was great.
Okay, well, I am alarmed. The more I think about it, I'm alarmed that he was so dismissive of Tony Blinken as unimpressive.
I was surprised by that.
And a staff man. So if Chris Wallace thinks that, what do you think the Taliban thinks?
Well, it's an interesting observation by Chris, because it is he is a staff man. That is his background. He was Biden's staff director on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's a staffer, and that's typically not who you put, in a job that Thomas Jefferson once had. And ultimately one of the things, kind of the flip side of that, you could argue Condi Rice was also seen as a Bush staff person, is that you are perceived as having the ear of the president. And I do think when Tony Blinken is talking to people overseas, not to defend him, but that, he is seen as someone who is kind of an appendage of Biden. And so that does give him some credibility, because he's not going to, unlike Rex Tillerson, say, get kind of undercut by the president on Twitter the next day.
Dr. Rice, as an African-American woman who survived Birmingham and made it in a white male world, I don't think anyone ever questioned her strength of character and purpose. And obviously you don't, you're a Stanford guy, but when Chris Wallace says staff man in D.C., that is as dismissive and brutal as it gets.
And so
do other people share that opinion? Do you share that opinion?
I've been blown away by how badly Afghanistan has gone. And I do think that Blinken is a very important part of that story. And I do think Biden does defer to Blinken. And I think Blinken didn't push back as hard on Biden as he should have, because I think there was this sense that, like, this is what the president wants to do, and we're going to do what the president wants to do, and so we're not going to go through all the reasons this is problematic. And that is one of the things that a staff person does who's not a principal. A principal who comes in having been in Congress or running a corporation is someone who has kind of their own power base and certain and worldview. And Blinken is very much a Biden guy. And I do think that ultimately has shortchanged the president on this hugely consequential issue. And I do worry that it will similarly cause problems on other big global issues that are coming down the pike. And of course, the most important of which is China.
Weakness is provocative is a saying among the Reaganauts. And my people, the center right, the national security conservatives, the constitutional conservatives, we are very worried about the next 3.5 years. Have you heard that from anyone? And not because they're going to spend the next three generations money. I'm worried about that. I'm just worried about the CCP and Russia, because weakness is provocative. I'm worried about Iran getting a nuke. Last 50 seconds to you, Jim. Do you worry about this because of the weakness of the people?
I do worry about all of those things, and I do think it's vitally important that Biden project strength. I think one of the things that we have to do coming out of this debacle in Afghanistan, I disagreed with it. I thought it was a terrible idea. I wrote that we should leave a residual force and that Biden should back off. I wrote that we shouldn't close Bagram. Ultimately, Biden did have an electoral mandate to do that. He ran on it. He followed through on his campaign promise. I thought it was a bad idea, but he did it. Now it's incumbent upon the administration to project strength to the world so that China and North Korea and Iran and others don't encroach.
And I agree with that. I just am completely pessimistic about that happening. James Holman, Washington Post, every single morning. You ought to be reading him. At James Holman on Twitter in the Washington Post with his column. I'll be right back. America on the Hugh Hewitt Show. All right, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.